Well, welcome along to the Lam Room classes, everybody. We'll begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. Then we'll take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment, engage in the seven limb prayer and offer a mandala. So please get comfortable in your seat. So your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed, and your eyes can be closed or kept open. And you're breathing normally and naturally. And you're aware of the movements that take place within the body whenever you inhale or exhale. And everything is slowing down and the mind is becoming more focused. And the Buddha and his entourage appear in the space in front of you. And all sentient beings surround you. And you bring to mind the suffering of others and their wish to overcome that suffering and to be happy. And you recognize that you are just like everybody else. You recollect that the causes of suffering can be eliminated and the potential for genuine happiness can be brought to fruition, and you decide to do this for yourself and for the sake of others. So to put an end to your own suffering and to help others do the same, and to develop all of your good qualities and help others do the same, is dependent upon relying upon others who have done that and the methods for doing it. I think that you're going to take refuge in the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas who are in front of you and above you for the sake of all beings who surround you. So reciting along with me, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this prayer, I think that lights and nectars come out from the hearts of the Buddha and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas surrounding them. They wash over you and they remove all the obstacles so that you can attain your wishes. And with all these obstacles removed, your potential is empowered. So now recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And having these four immeasurable thoughts of compassion, love, joy, and equanimity awoken, decide to establish all beings within these four boundless and immeasurable states. So again, lights and nectars come forth from the hearts of the Buddhas and the enlightened beings, washing over you and of all beings surrounding you. Imagine having the four immeasurable thoughts established within you. And seeing yourself in front of the refuge field, be prepared to make prostrations and offerings and declare anything that needs to be laid down. So reciting along with me, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And now to remove any vestiges of clinging to the merit we've accumulated, we'll offer the mandala of the body transformed into a wonderful pure land. So reciting again, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayatayami. The mandala has been released and it's been accepted by the Buddha and his entourage, and they smile at us with delight. And we look up into the eyes of the central figure. We feel accepted and at ease. And then an emanation leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head. We're facing in the same direction. The emanation begins to descend, entering the crown of your head, from down through your body, and stops at the level of your heart. The radiance of his body begins to expand, filling your mind and body with light. And the light goes out through the pores of your skin and fills the 10 directions of space. Wherever there are beings within space, think that they are touched by this light and completely awoken. And there is no difference between them and yourself. So here, think that all conceptual designations have broken down. It's just a vast, light pervading. And the light begins to withdraw. And as it withdraws, the world reappears. The light re-enters your heart, you feel yourself embodied, sitting on your seat, and you're breathing normally and naturally. And you know that although this has all taken place on the level of imagination, it has left an imprint upon your mind to bring about your own awakening and the awakening of all sentient beings through the achievement of perfect full enlightenment. And you breathe in deeply through your nostrils and you exhale through your mouth. And you let your eyes flutter open and find yourself in the seat. So, where are we? This is the 21st teaching in this unit, the third unit. And here we're up to the section on the development of karma abiding, or especially of karma abiding, also called what else?
Stabilization.
Sorry?
Stabilization.
It is. So we have meditative stabilization and
is serenity, is it?
Serenity. Thank you, Fran. Yeah. Serenity is what I was looking for. So here are some of the books that I've been relying upon in this section of the teachings. We have this book here called The Study and Practice of Meditation, Tibetan Interpretations of the Concentrations and Formless Absorptions. I have it here in front of me and it's very, very helpful to get into the detail of this material. And then we have Balancing the Mind by Alan Wallace, which is a commentary on this section of the Lamrim Chenmo. Geshe Sopa's book I've also relied on a lot today, and Following the Buddha's Footsteps. And of course, it's all coming out of this great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment. And our commentary, given by Khyentse Rinpoche about 17 years ago now. And a lot of questions today. It was a big section to go through. So we've got 31 questions. And for Caroline, so it's day 21, Caroline. So let's go through some of the questions here. So our first question begins.
So, at Eddie,
yeah.
I've got day 21, module 3, day 21, and it's only got 15 questions.
Yeah, well, if you start breaking them up, you'll find there's a lot more there than that.
Oh, I see. So it's this basic 15. So it's just this basic one pager which has the table about the 18 constituents?
No, it's much further than that. That was, what, last week or the week before?
Okay, that says day 21 for me. Okay, so what's the first question?
This is in the section on the meditative process, there are two presentations given about how to develop calm abiding.
Okay.
What are these presentations and the sources for each?
Right.
Okay.
Got it.
Thank you. Goody. Okay, so the first presentation we've got is called The Five Faults and Eight Antidotes. And it comes from Maitreya's Separation of the Middle from the Extremes. And then we have the six powers, the four types of attention, and the nine mental states from Asanga's Shravaka levels. So when these are normally explained, and you'll see this in the text too. Remember a number of years ago, we had the Sydney to take teachings on this, and the Lama did it really well. So he just did, on the first day, we did the presentation by Maitreya, the five faults and eight antidotes. The second day was the six powers, four types of attention, and nine mental states. And the third pulled them all together. So they can be all together, but when you learn them, you should learn them one and then the other. Our next question is, what must we do before we begin to focus attention on the object of meditation? What must we do before we begin to focus on the object of meditation? So in the text, you'll see the answers were basically that we need to try to abstain from the five faults and to really to be very careful of laziness. But if you look back even further, you'll see that before we begin to engage in the practice of calm abiding, we need to accumulate the four perfections that are previous to it and act as a foundation, and gather the six preconditions for actually practicing, and then go to abandon the five faults as we engage in practice. And of course, within these five faults, there is one of them, the major one we need to disengage with or abandon in the beginning, which is called spiritual sloth or laziness. So laziness is to be understood here as a lack of delight or to have no desire to cultivate concentration. Of course, if you have any questions as we go along or you need something to a bit more said about something, please let me know. So we need to remove this spiritual sloth, and there are four antidotes to help us do this. So mental pliancy is the actual fulfillment of the antidotes, but it's always present as we engage in trying to remove this spiritual sloth. It depends upon a state of joyous perseverance, which is dependent upon a real wish to achieve calm abiding. And this wish is dependent upon the conviction that we can actually attain serenity or calm abiding. I'll just say something here about pliancy itself. It says the Galupa present calm abiding as a stable, heightened meditative state in which the mind is focused tightly on an object of observation and both the mind and the object are clear and vibrant. A meditator who has calm abiding can focus the mind on the object of observation without distraction at will for as long as he or she wishes and has complete control over the process. This mental and physical serviceability is known as pliancy. So this is taken from Leah Zahler's book, The Study and Practice of Meditation, on page 63. Okay, our next question is, so to do this, of course, when we engage in the practice of meditation, we need to have an object to meditate upon. And here we have this question about these objects. They're saying that when we have an object and we're focused upon that object, is that meditation an apprehension of signs? And then we are to explain why it is or why it isn't. So this, the apprehension of signs is usually a reference to grasping a true existence. But in our tradition, the Galupa tradition, the tradition put forward by Lama Tsongkhapa, and especially within this context, apprehension of signs refers to the reference point or the focus for our meditation. So every meditation that focuses on an object is not an apprehension of the signs of inherent existence. So I put here, not necessarily. Because in general, we're saying, you know, it is an apprehension. Any apprehension of signs is the signs of grasping inherent existence. But within this context, it's not. And you'll see that there's some debate about this. Fran, you had your hand raised, yeah?
Yeah, look, I mean, how can we say not necessarily? You know, I mean, do we just... I just didn't quite understand how you were sort of saying that, you know, we are grasping a true existence when you're not, you know, sort of thing. I just didn't understand that. Can you clarify? That's the one.
Okay, so I'm thinking here, so in the other traditions of the Lingma, Shakya, and Kagyu, this object is a conventionally existent object that we're engaging with, isn't it? All conventionally existent objects have signs of inherent existence from their perspective. So the reason for this is, so Miffy and I were talking about this over the weekend. I've been reading a fantastic book on the two truths. And from their perspective, every conventional consciousness is not only mistaken, it's wrong. So they're all appearing to have inherent, of course, they're all appearing to have inherent existence. So they say, so, you know, this is an apprehension of signs, the signs of inherent existence. So if you, like, and so as Geshe said, if you take that through, so then how are you going to get, how are you going to realize emptiness?
What are you saying here, that we need to sort of understand that from a conventional sense we see things, but from a true sense they are empty of inherent existence. So we're trying to sort of participate in the world in a conventional sense, but see it differently or see it for what it is? Because otherwise it gets really confusing.
From a couple's perspective, from this perspective, our tradition's perspective, so the Lama Tsongkhapa presents the two truths as a unification, unified, right? Every object is empty of inherent existence.
And I appreciate that. Yeah. But for us to exist,
yeah,
and to sort of engage with people who don't see it as the way we see it, we, yeah, need to speak in a conventional way. Otherwise, they think we're nuts and that's, we need to be locked away. Yeah.
So the, yeah, object then, so and same, so we take that same idea, and when the object appears to us, we have to have an object to meditate on, right?
Which lacks inherent existence, but we just need to understand that it is there. conventionally.
Yeah, yeah, and it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we have a conventional object, that's our object of focus. We're focusing on that object. And that's it. Especially within this context of developing calm abiding.
So if I say to myself, that object there is a, well, not so much a hallucination, but a projection of my mind or a thought that I'm sort of seeing is more solid, even though it's not, that's an okay thing to do.
Well,
or am I, is that erroneous?
Yeah, you're grasping at the inherent existence of it, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not grasping, I'm just acknowledging that it is inherent existence. No.
It doesn't have any inherent existence. It appears to have inherent existence.
Oh, well, that's what I mean. I'm acknowledging that it appears to have. So from a conventional sense, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
This is so confusing, Eddie. You know, I can sort of understand it, but I don't understand it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, Fran, that's why it's confusing, because this is the machinery of samsara.
You two must have the most amazing discussions. I'd love to be a fly on your wall.
Well, I really appreciate them, Fran. So I was just sitting out the other day talking to Miffy about something. Wow, I never ever thought I'd end up talking with a woman, a girlfriend, having these discussions. And if they're actually getting it, they can reflect back to me, you know, and laugh about it, things like this, and actually talk about it.
Who's our lucky man there, Eddie? Well, thank you anyway. It has clarified it a bit, but it just, yeah, I just need to sort of, maybe I just need to go back and read a bit more about the two truths, I think.
Well, there is that, yeah. Also, it's context here. Right? So we've got to remember context. We're just trying to develop the calm abiding. So we actually need to have an object to focus our mind upon.
Even though it lacks inherent existence.
Yeah, yep. Of course, right. Because everything lacks inherent existence. Yeah. So even though, right, like you say, it might appear to have inherent existence, well, of course it does. That's not the problem. That's not a thing here.
Yeah. Okay. It's a, yeah, so that's where the not necessarily comes in, right?
Yeah, and the other people say, like, if you're focusing on an inherently existent object, all you're doing there really is just familiarizing your mind with inherent existence, aren't you?
Yeah.
And they're sort of saying there's no object. We should be meditating on nothing. Lava Tsongkhapa is saying, if you say that, you have nothing. If you have no object, then there's no consciousness involved. Because the object of consciousness depends upon consciousness.
Oh, well, there is no spoon. Anyway, it's okay. I'll leave it at that. Otherwise, we won't get through the 31. Right. Okay. Thanks, Eddie.
Sorry, I have to. There is a spoon. There's what you've got to say, Fran, is there is no real spoon.
But it's a conventional spoon, though, isn't it? I mean, there is a conventional spoon that's.
But there's no real conventional spoon.
No. Well, where did real come from? Because isn't it about lack of inherent existence, no lack of true existence? Is that so? Real is another word for those you're using. Yeah. But it has to function as a spoon, Fran.
Fair enough, Carolyn. Eat that birthday cake with a kiss.
That's right. Conventionally labelled birthday cake on the basis of having the ice cream and all of that.
That's right. So you can ask Carolyn, where is the birthday cake? Can it be found?
But the conventional birthday cake, based on the appropriate basis of designation with the label cake, exists.
Yeah, well, and conventionally it's a minute on the lips, a month on the hips, so, you know, we sort of get it.
Okay, back to you, Eddie.
That's a good one. So here's a little bit more about that. So what makes a meditation a meditation on emptiness. So I like this. So I took this from the Lamrim Chenmo on page 39, it's paragraph 2. He says, whether something constitutes meditation on emptiness is determined by whether it is meditation founded upon the view that knows the way things are. It is not determined by whether there is any conceptualization vis-a-vis the object. Now, that last little bit refers to the last slide. So it's not whether the object has any appearance of inherent existence. What's determining this meditation upon emptiness is a view that realizes lack of inherent existence. So what makes a meditation on emptiness must be founded upon the view that realizes the way things are. What is a view that realizes the way things are? A view that realizes lack of inherent existence. A view that realizes a lack of existing by way of its own character, existing from its own side and so forth. So Khyentse Rinpoche says, an awareness that realizes emptiness has a particular view. And this is the view that you have to base your meditation on emptiness upon. And this is the distinction between a meditation upon emptiness and one that is not. So meditation on emptiness does not refer to simply not conceiving of anything at all or not paying attention to anything at all. And this is what he's saying here refers to the previous slide and the views of these other tenet systems and schools. Anyway, let's move on. So now we're going to look at some of these sections on what they call the different purifiers. Caroline?
So there's also when they have things about meditation on emptiness, they talk about a generic image.
Yeah, that's right.
So are you saying here there a view that realizes lack of inherent existence seems quite advanced, but where does... You know, when they say that you have a generic image of emptiness that you're meditating on,
yep.
Where does that come in?
Well, that's your conceptual, that's your the correct idea of what emptiness is. Right? So you have to, that's your object to meditate on. If you don't have that, then what do you have?
Yes. Well, I'm not sure what my generic view image is.
Well, that's where you have to get, like you use the reasoning to get to that.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you sort of meditate often enough, you'll automatically have that image come up anyway, won't you? Whatever you designate that image to be. So it's a familiarization, is it?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. And that image, that generic image, looks like space. Right? So when you look at its, you know, so space is defined as the absence of obstructive content. But there's nothing you can bump into. Sorry, what was that, Sue?
Contact. I can't hear you.
Sorry? You lost it. So, you know, so there's no obstruction there. You can't be obstructed by anything. Right? There's an absence of that. So it's just like emptiness of inherent existence is the absence of inherent existence. What was thought to be there is seen to not be there. So there's a not. And all you have, and that is the generic image. You are to get like a knot there. Like for instance, if you, when you look at inherent existence, if you ask yourself, "Do I inherently exist?" You know, like you have to sort of Sapienga. Okay, so that's my question. And you go, well, if I were to inherently exist, how would I exist? What would I look like? What would that appearance be? And you have only two choices. And you look in both places and you see you're not there. That is not the I. So you get it, like that's what they call it, a negation. Emptiness is a negation of inherent existence. So inherent existence, as you know, has never existed. But it's always appearing to you as if it did. So you're going to look at that appearance.
It just exists in our own mind or our own labeling.
So we say that, Fran, the thing is that we believe it. We say, okay, so it just appears in my mind or it just appears to my senses. And you believe it. Because it's not so much the appearance of inherent existence, it's the grasping at it that's the problem. It's the belief that what we're engaging with is true. So like for ourselves, you go, okay, so what's the belief about ourselves that we think is true?
Well, whatever we choose to think about ourselves at that point of time, and that's sort of reflected by our thought process
So the ideas that I think about myself are true. So then you take these ideas. The ideas we could go right down to and go say, I am the body. I am the mind. There's two ideas we have about ourselves.
Yeah, I understand there's no truth in that, but yeah. But.
Okay. So that's a simple one. That's called gross emptiness. Okay, what do you think the subtle one is?
And now I'm not known for my subtleties.
the label I exists inherently. But the name itself inherently exists. So in other words, my identity is inherently existent. Because what inherent existence has to have a basis of something that does exist. Right? So you don't have just inherent existence without a basis. You've got to have an object, a phenomena that appears to inherently exist. And that phenomena has to conventionally exist. It actually has to exist. That thing that actually exists, the conventional phenomena, now appears to us as if it truly existed or inherently existed. So we've got to take the conventional thing, the thing that does exist, and see if that conventionality inherently exists. So the convention, if we look at ourselves, right? So here we're looking for the subtle emptiness, the middle way Prasangika presentation, the subtle emptiness of the person. You go, okay, it has to be the conventional person. What is the conventional person?
Imputed on the body and mind.
Say that again, Sue.
The mere I that is imputed on the body and mind.
That's right. So it's the mere I imputed to the body and mind. That's just not the body, it's not the mind, it's the mere I that's imputed to the body and mind. This mere I, this label, just the label itself, I, appears to have inherent existence. And so we say, okay, well, if it actually does so, if it actually did have inherent existence, it would have to be one with some exactly the same as something else, or completely different. So we can investigate and find a cause that unknown. There'll be an absence. So it is the conventionally existent phenomena that are empty of inherent existence. So always we've got to find the conventionally existent phenomena. So it's the person, so it's like Sue said, what's the person? It's the I that's merely imputed, the mere I. So we see that this is the label, isn't it? So does a label have inherent existence? No, the label depends upon a basis. So we don't inherently exist.
Eddie?
Yep.
When Kenshin Rinpoche says the eye and the mind go side by side, is he talking about the subtle fundamental mind?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, but even now, you know, we could say, well, I see, and so that's a more gross type of consciousness. And so it goes along right with that too. But in terms of the continuum of the eye, yes, then we're really talking about the continuum of the subtle consciousness.
And just the other clarity, that when you say a generic image, you're saying, I gather, that's the image, say, of a deity or no image.
That's
an image, is it? Yes.
That's
when you talk about an image, you're not talking about the something that it still can be, say, for example, a deity, but it looks like space, but it's still an image.
Yeah, so we have
that the
generic
image, have an image
of a deity. We have a generic image of a deity. We've actually got to have a deity appear. And we know that's a conceptual construct. This term, generic image, is just another word for conception.
Okay, thank you.
So the next question says, we previously looked at five objects of meditation to purify behavior. So what kind of people should meditate on each object? And to what end? Okay. So for a person who has a lot of desire, they should meditate upon the ugliness or the unpleasant to purify attachment. So remember, the question is, what kind of people should meditate on each object? And to what end? What are they trying to do by meditating on this object? So we're saying here, a person who has a lot of desirous energy, a lot of desirous attachment, should be meditating on the unpleasant, the ugliness of objects, to purify their attachment. So here, purify, it's got two meanings. The major one here, though, is to stop attachment. So here we have a person who has a predominance of anger or hatred needs to meditate on love and kindness to purify their ill will and hatred. So this is the sort of person, and the result is to be free of ill will and hatred and be more loving, kind person. So a person who is predominance of deluded, needs to meditate upon the dependent arising to purify attachment to self. The arrogant or proud person needs to meditate upon the differentiation of the constituents to purify the pride of being attached to the constituents. And finally, a person who thinks too much. This person should meditate upon inhalation and exhalation to purify ideation. So ideation is a specific type of conceptualization, in other words, a specific type of thinking, which has the general characteristic of apprehending its main object by way of an idea of it. So like I'm looking right at Sue now, but if I start thinking a lot about Sue, right, this is what this is getting at. I'm apprehending the main object, Sue, by a lot of ideas about Sue. And I'm getting at the mental idea of Sue and thinking a lot about it. So while conceptualization is indispensable for such mental functions as memory and inference, in Buddhist literature, the term ideation normally carries a negative connotation, suggesting a compulsive and at times chaotic outflow of discursive thought. The prescribed remedy for compulsive ideation or discursiveness is to attend to the respiration, for example, by counting each inhalation and exhalation or following the breath. You've got all those different breathing exercises you can do. Is this okay? Okay, we'll move on to the next one. So it says here, what about people with slight afflictions whose behavior is balanced? So here it says, in brief, work at whichever object you like to attain just the mental stability. So in the Lamrim Chenma, it says, if you are a person whose behavior is balanced, or one whose afflictions are slight, then it suffices to keep your attention on whichever of the objects of meditation you like. It's not necessary to have a particular one. Asanga says those whose behavior is balanced should work at whichever object they like to attain just mental stability. So this is not for the purpose of purifying behavior here. It's the same with when you have the slight afflictions. It's what we're trying to do is to try and get a balanced mind, make it stable. But balanced behavior means that you're not fully involved in attachment and the others in your previous lives. You do not become accustomed to them and you do not express them frequently. Still, you have not recognized that they are faults and you have not suppressed them or repudiated them. So while attachment and such are not predominant or of great duration, it's not as though they do not occur.
Eddie.
Yes.
I was looking for the little icon to put my hand up, but I can't find it.
I said, can you speak up?
No, it's to do with the last part about someone who is... filled with attachment should meditate on the ugliness of the object.
Yeah.
I can't understand that. Well, I understand what they mean, but like last night I saw a vase online and I thought it was beautiful. And I started thinking about this with notes and I couldn't find anything ugly about that vase that would make me not buy it. But I tried, but I couldn't. So...
Yep. So what was the vase made of?
Oh, ceramic, I suppose, or something. I don't know.
Okay, so if it was ceramic, what's the basis for ceramic?
No, or the material, I don't know. I don't know what makes up ceramics. Some kind of...
It's sort of some sort of clayish mix, isn't it?
It's clay.
Yeah, well, probably. Yeah.
White clayish type thing. So what you do with that sort of thing, that's what you do to it is you break it down into its parts.
Mm. Eddie, you can also, there's also the aspect, well, especially with a porcelain vase, that you may not be able to find anything ugly, but if the cat knocks it off the table and it smashes, it's going to bring suffering.
Yeah, I thought of that as well, Mithy, because this is a beautiful vase. It's a lady's face and she's got flowers all around her head. And I thought, I'd love that for my barbecue area. But if I put it up on the shelf that I want to put it on in the barbecue area, the wind could easily knock it down.
There you go. So it's not all perfect.
That's
what you've got. This is not the
question, actually. This question is about the
ugliness. I found another shelf for it.
So you can find faults.
Anything ugly about that vase.
No, that's right. So that's right. You can find other faults other than the ugliness of it.
Hmm.
Right? But this one is actually saying the ugliness. Right? And when you actually look at the ugliness, it's broken up into about four different types of ways of looking at the ugliness of things. So it's not just the one that we might think of, it looks ugly.
Hmm.
There are different things. Of course, here, The major things here is to be looking at one's own. The major thing we have attachment to is our own body, a body of ourselves or the bodies of others. And so this is where the ugliness thing really comes in. But like I say, you know, when you look at with the vase one, is you look at what makes it up to be so beautiful, and what you're going to end up with is dirty clay that's mixed up with a type of water.
Yeah, fair enough, but it doesn't put me off it, though.
So when you look at the grey clay, that before it's fired and put into that oven and all the artwork and sort of thing is going into it, right?
Mm.
So when you look at just the grey clay mixed with the water, is that what you really want?
No, definitely not.
Do you think that's really beautiful?
No.
No. That's what, if you just leave what you've done on the surface and look at it, no, it's not going to look ugly to you. And it's the same thing with people. If you just look at, if somebody has a beautiful skin and looks beautiful, you're going to go, okay, so I am attracted to them, I have attachment to them, and yet I'm being asked here to meditate on their ugliness. Where's the ugliness?
I can understand that, meditating on ugliness of the body, because I've read about how you went to the insides and the organs and everything else.
Yeah.
But to me, for that, be able to do that on a vase and cut the attachment to buying that vase, no, I can't. I just don't think it works.
Well, it's the same process, isn't it?
So, Eddie, especially with things like a vase, Jeanette, it's like if someone humiliated or belittled you about your taste in vases, and if they did it publicly, and so you started having a traumatic or unpleasant association with that vase, then, you know, every time you saw a vase, that one or one even like that, all these associated unhappy feelings would arise, and now suddenly that vase, you go, well, you know, I used to like vases like that, but I don't like them anymore. So it's like even the beauty it's not in the vase, it's because it's at the moment associated with pleasant experiences.
Yeah, I do understand all that.
Yeah, but that's away from the actual antidote that they're talking about here.
Hmm.
Yeah, those are other antidotes you can use to bring out attachment.
But a lot of that is desirous attachment that they're talking about with looking, you know, the body and, you know, da-di-da. What about when it's another sort of attachment like to, you know, children and, you know, like you can sort of, you know, dissect your child and all its bits and pieces, but that doesn't mean that you ever find them ugly, because there's this other layer of attachment through, you know, the karmic link you have to the child. I mean, you know, a child that you bear has a karmic connection to you strongly, or, you know, so how does that work as an antidote to attachment for children?
Well, you have to realise that it's just karma. It's just dependently arisen karma. There's no actual person that you can have that to.
So thinking about the karmic view, which is what I do, that's the way, sort of more the way to try and unpack it?
No, because that's not what attracts you. What attracts you is their pleasant appearance.
Mm-mm, no.
Well, put it this way, children, look at your children. You start thinking that you just look at them, right? Now, do you start thinking about karma?
Yeah.
Does their appearance come first or the karma?
Well, because I've worked on it, the karma now. I mean, some of them, their appearance isn't particularly attractive, you know.
Well, that's why it's saying it's attractive. You have to want it. You have to actually see. This is what the attachment is. This is what the ugliness is to be an antidote towards.
Yeah, but it's more the desirous attachment. I mean, I've read it's more for, you know, in the monasteries where, you know, monks got sort of sexually attracted to women and, you know, had vows and stuff so that they do this sort of analysis. But, you know, in other situations, you know, it's that sort of, I think I'm with Jeanette that it's sort of, you know, like, it's not the universal antidote to desirous attachment.
No, I suppose, Carolyn, if anyone's, you know, changed really disgusting nappies in that moment, you know, you're not thinking about karma and you're not thinking about how attractive they are. You're just trying not to retch.
Oh, rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
No. Look, I'm listening to this, but I think, you know, just looking at life in general, everything, everybody, it's still, for me, you can still see the beauty and appreciate the beauty in whatever is on this planet, but and without needing to see it as ugly, but I'm still understanding that it lacks total inherent existence, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah.
So
do we have to see it ugly though? I don't. I'd rather see the.
So ugly also doesn't just mean.
The thing is afflicted behavior, like folks. It's afflicted behavior.
So ugly is also like a
word, isn't it?
An angry face. You know, a child having a tantrum. It's not to do with looks. It's appearance to our mind, not our eyes.
I think that one's complex.
The thing is, all in that word, the terminology, it doesn't exist. Well, I'm looking at your jumper, Eddie, and I'm thinking, oh, that's gorgeous, gorgeous jumper. There's no way I could break that down to think it was ugly. No
way. Think about the sheep that it came from, you know, just that's where but look, I think the thing is, you know, everything none of us actually have the time to think like that, you know. I mean, basically what happens in my mind is it's an instantaneous thing, you know, and then you just move on, you know. So yeah. But I don't sort of try and examine my desire to have things and stuff, and yet I can understand you know, wanting things. Yeah, you know, so I now have to ask myself, well, do I want it or do I need it, you know? And, you know, if it's not necessary for my survival, I don't necessarily buy it, you know. So that's my way around it.
The attachment, right, this desirous attachment, you know, there's a number of things that have got to take place, don't you? But the object has actually got to be appealing to you. It's got to actually appeal to your senses. But that's one thing. Then the beauty of it, or it's this wonderful appearance, has to be coming from the side of the object itself, and you are to see no flaws in it. Only the good appears to you. Then you want to possess it. And so first, we've got the appearance side of it, which you buy into, and then you want to possess it. And make it yours. So the thing that will stop you doing that is to see that object as ugly in some way. That's what it's sort of saying here, isn't it? And if you could, then that would stop you having attachment to it, wouldn't it?
It might be for it's, but it just doesn't work the same way for things like an attachment to a child.
Why not?
I've tried it, you know.
Okay, like, Caroline, let your child die and have its decomposing corpse in bed with you and hang on to it. and tell me that's lovely. That's beautiful. I love my dead child.
Well, I mean, but I know that, you know, that but that's a dead child. What continues on, though, Eddie, is the sort of, you know, at other levels. It's sort of, you're just talking about the body level with the, you know, decomposing. It's mere body, but it's sort of, that's not what I've, you know, it's the relationships, the, you know, it's other levels.
It's your relationship to a body.
No, it's...
Then if your body's not there, what relationship do you have? What child do you have if your child's body does not exist?
Yeah, and well, also, I've tried to work on my attachment to her for quite some time, and it.
Well, I'll give you an example. If you find it really hard, Carolyn. So I ruined when my wife died, when Tash died, right? So her corpse is in the bed there, and I'm lying beside it, looking at it, and thinking about this stuff, and going, man, if I just left this corpse here, this body that I call Tash, how long would it be before I thought, fucking get this out of here?
Mm.
It wouldn't take long.
But that's not Tash. It wasn't.
I'm sorry I started.
No.
Don't apologise, Jeanette.
I think it's a great one, but I think it just highlights the difference between, you know, kind of various objects of attachment, I believe.
Carolyn, there's something here that that might help, which is that especially when it comes to relationships, so like, you know, with children or with our pets or with our, you know, that there's a time lag. So we can go through a time where, like Eddie said, it appears that the goodness is coming from them and we don't see any faults. And that could go on for quite a long time, and that's why people, you know, like babies. But then when time changes things, then the appearance to our mind changes. So either we get, you know, really, really tired, or they become a terrible toddler, or they grow up and they become a criminal or a junkie and they disappoint us. And so then all the beauty that appeared to come from them and all the goodness that appeared to come from them is now not coming from them anymore.
No, it's gone through all those stages. The one that helps the most now is emptiness, but I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, this is one, so then you could say, for a person who has a lot of desirous energy, this was the antidote, right? So if you don't have that, of course not. Why would this be the antidote? You could go to emptiness if that's your major thing, or karma, cause and effect. But this is not for those people.
Hmm.
This is for, and that's why you go down through here, that one there would be dependent arising, as you say, attachment to self or the constituents. But for each major delusion that a person has, we have a major antidote for it. That's what's being said here. Now, of course, you could use any of these other antidotes too for the delusion, but the primary antidote is one of these. And that's why it's often said where these antidotes only work for really the one thing in many cases, whereas emptiness for all of them.
And this one, Eddie, it works for food as well, because if you're looking at delicious food and thinking, oh, you know, yummy cheesecake or chocolate or whatever, all you have to do is see it as poo and all of our attraction, we don't have to think about it, it's just over.
Yeah, that's right. So.
Still doesn't stop me from eating it, though, Miffy.
Well, then you just say your attachment.
Particularly ice cream cake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these are, anyway, these are for afflicted behaviour. We've gone through slight afflictions and balanced behaviour. Then we come to the objects for expertise. So here, what are the five objects of meditation for expertise? That's quite simple. The aggregates, the constituents, the sources, dependent arising, and what is and is not possible. So those are the five objects of meditation for expertise. And then it says, who should meditate on each of these? So this is what you're to know. So the person is to know these things to become experts in it. But here's the commentary taken from a sutra. So this is the Buddha talking to a monk called Ravata. And the Buddha says to Ravata, if a monk yogi, a practitioner of yoga, is confused about the characteristic nature of all composite things, or confused about the thing called person, self, living being, life, that which is reborn, or the nourisher, he should just focus his mind on the objects of meditation for expertise in the aggregates. And with his expertise in the aggregates, he understands that apart from the aggregates, there is no person, no entity distinct from those aggregates. Then, if he is confused about causes, he should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in the constituents. If he is confused about conditions, he should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in the sources. If he's confused about impermanence, suffering, and selflessness, that person should focus on the objects of meditation for expertise in dependent arising and on what is and is not possible. So there we have the different objects for expertise and a person who can be mistaken with these objects and what they need to meditate upon so they can gain expertise in them.
Excuse me, Yeti.
Yeah.
What's constituents?
The constituents are the aggregate sources. These are just the, I think it's just another way of getting at these.
Eddie, may I contribute?
Yeah.
It's the six sense powers, the six objects, and the six consciousness.
Yeah. Well, this is, yeah, it's like the things that makes it all up. The constituents of the, as Chris said, the lived experience. So here we have the, so we'll have to do this next one and then we'll have the break, yeah? Because this ties up with a lot of the other one that we had, where we went into this, the purifiers for afflictive behavior. Yeah. So when we come to this next question asks, what are the objects of meditation for dispelling afflictions? And who should meditate on which one? So for Buddhists and non-Buddhists, we have the attachment of the desire realm and all the afflictions associated with that attachment. So to put an end to that, to dispel those, you look at the coarseness of these afflictions of the desire realm. And you wonder, like, can I have something better? You see, yeah, the calmness of the form realm. There, these afflictions don't exist like they do. These afflictions don't exist like they do in the desire realm. So, for instance, anger is no longer existence within the form realm. So we look, it's like saying there's something better. And I know the way that these things are, and it's not very good. I'm not happy with them. I want something better. And that something better does exist, so I'm going to aim for that. And that's what a Buddhist can do and a non-Buddhist. In fact, the Buddhist will have to do this. And so non-Buddhist could do the same. Buddhist and non-Buddhist, you look at the attachments of the form realm and say, no, it's not as good as I expected. It could be better. So they look at the coarseness of that form realm. They are, the formless realm is even better. So I go in that direction.
Excuse me, Eddie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Here to ask another question. How can you imagine what the coarseness of the form realm is if you don't know, or the coarseness of the formless realm? I know there's states of mind, but how can you do that if you don't know what they really are, if you've never experienced them?
No, well, mainly through reading and study. It's like, you know, like, so I haven't...
Right.
You know, it's like, just, you know, we do a similar thing now, don't we? There's a lot of things we haven't experienced, but we want to. And so we might read and study about them and go, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So then we make an effort to have that experience.
So is it really like the afflictions, as you move from each realm, it's the removal of afflictions?
No, not the removal of them.
The suppression of them.
They can't manifest. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yep.
Okay. Now, so a Buddhist has to do this, and so do non-Buddhists. But this is just for the Buddhists. So they've got to give up attachment to the body and mind that's been taken under the control of karma and delusion, the perishing aggregates. They want to put it, of course, we want to put an end to uncontrolled rebirth, and that's taking place for the craving and grasping and so forth. So they're going to use the serenity or the calm abiding as a basis for insight into the 16 attributes of the Four Noble Truths. So I just want to add a little bit to fill this material out, and we can have a break. Okay? So the objects of observation or purifying afflictive emotions, this chart we're talking about here, are used during the preparations for the concentrations, when the meditator has already achieved calm abiding and is trying to attain an actual concentration. So this is from the Lamrim Trimbo now. So if you wish to be free from the attachment of the desire realm, you focus your mind on the coarseness of the desire realm and the calmness of the form realm. Right, so this is that first one there. If you wish to be free from the attachment of the form realm, focus your mind on the coarseness of the form realm and the calmness of the formless realm. If you wish to become disenchanted with all the perishing aggregates and wish to be free from them, then focus your mind on the truth of suffering, the truth of origins, the truth of cessation, and the truth of the path. Now, this is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says about this material, this part of the teaching, following in the Buddha's footsteps. It's on page 211. So one is a mundane path leading to the attainment of higher meditative absorptions in this life, birth in the form or formless realm in the next life, and perhaps the first five super knowledges. This path involves mundane insight, which contemplates the drawbacks or the grossness of the lower states of meditation absorption and the benefits, the peacefulness, of the higher states within cyclic existence, and results in suppressing the afflictions. This path is common to both Buddhists and non-Buddhists. So this first section here, this attachment to the desire realm, form realm, and so forth, it's a mundane path. It doesn't lead you out of cyclic existence. But what it does do is it suppresses temporarily these afflictions, especially the afflictions of the attachment, coming out of attachment.
So, Eddie, I find this quite disturbing because you just don't want to get sidetracked that way, because I just know in my own experience that if I'm feeling all calm and okay, it's very tempting to think, oh, it's fixed.
Yeah, no, that's right. Of course, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. We're okay. It's okay.
So this is this really shows how we really need to develop the wisdom to know if it is fixed or indeed how to fix it, rather than just suppress it or be free of it momentarily and go, you know, beauty.
Mm. So here we've got the mundane path that the Buddhists can go through, need to engage in, but we want to go like further. So he says the other is a super mundane path in which serenity is used as the basis for the cultivation of insight into the 16 attributes of the four truths, especially selflessness and emptiness. So this is unique to Buddhist practitioners and leads to nirvana and full awakening. Now, serenity or calm abiding is required to proceed on either of these two paths, whether it's the mundane or the super mundane. You need the serenity, the calm abiding. Okay, so it's 11:30. I don't think we're going to get through our teaching today. We've gone through like 10 of the slides, and there's another 21 to go. So now we're coming to the section really about the object that we are meditating upon, the object that we're becoming familiar with. And our first question is, why are these objects called images? Anybody have an answer here for this? Anybody make an attempt or read this material and come up with an answer?
Bruce? They're a mental appearance of the object of meditation.
They are a mental appearance of the object of meditation?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Mental appearance. That's right. Yeah, yep. That's right. That's a good one, Bruce. That's simply put. The objects of meditation appear to mental consciousness, which is exactly what Bruce has said. So Kensa Rinpoche says the concentration we're talking about developing here is a mental consciousness. To develop this type of concentration, something must arise and appear to the primary mental consciousness. You must have some type of image for that concentration to be developed. And that's what we're talking about. So this is from Leah Zala, that study and practice of Tibetan Buddhism. Image refers to the dawning of the object. The present Dalai Lama explains this dawning of the object as, for instance, the visualized image of the body of a Buddha that has been found as a result of previous study of an image seen with an eye consciousness. This image is called a reflection and is the object of observation. One of the other lamas, Gidan Lodro, explains that there are two types of object of observation called images, because the varieties of objects of observation are not observed nakedly, but are perceived by means of an image. He points out that this image is what is called a meaning generality or generic image. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? We just remember that, like what Bruce said, it's the image appearing to your mental consciousness, not any other consciousness. And here are, the next question was, what are some of the synonyms for the image? And these are five of them, I think I put down. There are even more, of course.
So, Eddie, can these also be mental images, say, of sounds? You know, like we're talking with Corey about an earworm?
Yep, that's right.
Or a mantra?
Right. Yep, that's right. Yeah. So here we've got the basis of attention, body of internal conceptualization, points upon which your attention is kept, a meditative base for concentration, a sign of concentration. So the resulting mental image, the visualized object, is referred to by different names in sutras and commentaries. Tsongkhapa mentions this here so that you'll not get confused. if you come across a variety of technical terms in your study of the subject. One phrase that is often used is sign of concentration. The term sign indicates a particular feature or focal point of the mind in meditative concentration. Two other synonyms are objects of shamatha and objects of concentration. These simply refer to the object utilized as the focal point of your attention in meditative stabilization. Another phrase found in canonical texts is technique of concentration. In order to develop perfect karma abiding, you must utilize the proper technique or method. Thus, method is another name. Another commonly utilized synonym is door to concentration. This refers to how the mental image is like the entryway to meditative stabilization.
Excuse me, Eddie, where are you reading this from?
From Geshe Sopa, page 73, the last
one. Oh, Geshe Sopa, right. No, I don't have Geshe Sopa.
There's still another phrase is base of attention. That refers to the basis upon which you fix your attention or concentration. A Sangha also mentions the phrase body of internal conceptualization, which refers to your image of internal thought. Okay, our next question is, so how do we choose the best object of meditation for ourselves? Well, first thing we should know that there is no single definite object for each of us. So that's what I've put up there. There is no single definite object for each of us. So if we are determined to achieve, from the Lamrim Chinmo, if we are determined to achieve karma abiding, at the very least, and if your behavior is dominated by attachment or another affliction, then you need to use a certain type of object of meditation. But if you do not, then you may attain a concentration that approximates karma abiding, but where you will not attain actual karma abiding. It is said that even if you train with an object of meditation for purifying behavior, you will not achieve karma abiding unless you do so for a very long time. So how could you ever achieve it by rejecting objects of meditation for purifying behavior? If you have a predominance of discursiveness or a lot of thinking, conceptualization, then you must meditate on the breath. And actually, you'll see later on when you actually start trying to develop these states of meditative stabilization before karma abiding. I think it's on like the third stage, between the third and the fourth, where you suddenly realize, oh crap, like I can't go any further. I need to go back now and change my object to deal with this problem that I've got before you can actually move on again, retake up the meditation and move on. So it's said, of course, as you know, that the best object for us is the Buddha. So what are the benefits of meditating on a Buddha? Now, I know that there are heaps of them, but I just couldn't find the text to give you a more comprehensive list of them. But in the Lamrim Chenpo, it basically says it gives rise to limitless merit. So I've put this, I've asked one of the ways that they mean by limitless merit, one of the ways of describing that is that at the time of death, it's very easy to recollect the Buddha. You produce a good rebirth in dependence upon something like that. But of course, there's lots of other ways. Of course, if you always walk around with the Buddha either at your heart or above the crown of your head, then you restrain yourself from behaving poorly. You really be aware of what you do with your body and the speech of your mind. And finally, it really gets us prepared for the practice of Tantra. And so if we're all become familiar with visualizing the Buddha and becoming familiar with his qualities, when we come to it in the different tantric practices, it's much easier. Okay, this next question asks, what are the results of meditating on the physical form of the Buddha? So did anybody find an answer for this? Because there wasn't one in the commentary. And this is the thing I found the other day, a great text, and oh, there's all the benefits and there's the results. And you can see they're quite different. Anyway, so as I tell you, this, the answer is not in the text. You can't find it in there. So it probably relied upon your hearing of previous other teachings. So Sue, do you have any ideas here? You might have a similitude. Yeah. It's basically this, right? The achievement of the form bodies of a Buddha. This is the greatest, best result. Now our next question is, why is the Buddha the best object to focus on after having dealt with any particularly strong afflictions? Well, we just put up three. You wish to have its good qualities. You're able to quell laxity and excitement, and a double purpose is achieved. So can you remember anything about what this double purpose might be and why in some other cases a double purpose is not achieved? So remember here concentration or meditative stabilization, we're really focusing on a mental object. So there's chances of having a single purpose or a double purpose. So what do you think the single purpose is then?
Calm abiding.
That's right. The single purpose is definitely calm abiding, right? You're able to quell laxity, excitement, and achieve calm abiding. So what might be the double purpose then?
Enlightenment, Eddie.
Yeah, I mean, that is that... The thing is, if you had an internal object that was not the Buddha, but you had calm abiding, would it still be possible to attain Buddhahood?
Calm abiding and special insight.
No. What we're asking here is, why is the Buddha the best object, is it? That was like up to saying, it is a huge... Meditate on the Buddha. The double purpose is achieved. So you've definitely got an object. I'll tell you, right? If you use an image of the Buddha with some knowledge of the Buddha and what his qualities are, then when you joyfully meditate on that object with faith, it is so much more beneficial than an object that's not Buddha. You contemplate the qualities of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind, and you wish to attain that state of perfection yourself in the future. When you use an object of shamatha meditation in that way, a double purpose will be achieved. This is obviously so much better than using an object that does not have anything special about it. Like there are other objects you can use, and they're simpler, like the breath. You can use the breath. It'll help you develop calm abiding, but does it remind you of all the good qualities of a Buddha? Do you have any desire to attain the state of a Buddha? Probably not. That's why the Buddha seem to be a very, very good object, serving this double purpose. Now, when we meditate on the Buddha, there are basically two ways to visualize or imagine them. And here are the two: to newly imagine the form of the Buddha, or to think that the form is naturally present. So the more powerful and advantageous way of visualization is the second.
Excuse me, Eddie.
Yes.
What does the first one mean, newly imagining the form?
Well, you have to sit there and start building them up in your mind. Right? So you have to start. Yeah, you start to imagine, to build it up. And the other is just
until you get
already.
All right, I see.
Yeah, Buddha's naturally present wherever I am. Buddha's there. So it's sitting. So Geshe Sopa again from page 78. There are two ways to go about visualizing the Buddha. The first is to visualize the Buddha as an object that you have mentally constructed. The second is to think that the Buddha is there in front of you, not a mere byproduct of your imagination. The second method is better, especially for the beginners, because it helps generate trust and faith. And this is something that's common to both the Mahayana and the Hinayana. The Labrum Chemite says, of the two ways to do this, newly imagining the Buddha's form and visualizing the Buddha's form as though it were naturally present, the second has a distinct advantage in developing faith and fits within the context of practices common to both sutra and tantra vehicles. Therefore, use a visualized image of the Buddha's form as though it was already naturally present. And I think, again, there's a couple of another question or so about that. It says, which is best and why? So we know the best is to imagine the Buddha being naturally present, develops conviction. It's common to both sutra and tantra. Having the Buddha naturally present has greater benefits, also helps you have more stable mindfulness. Again, from Geshe Sopa, first, if you are very familiar with your object, at the time of death, you can recollect the qualities of the Buddha and take refuge. And if you practice visualizing an image of the Buddha now, doing tantric practices later will be much easier. In tantric practices such as deity yoga, there are times when you need to clearly visualize the deity in front of you. And then there are times when you need to imagine yourself as that deity. Okay, maybe. No, I'm not going to make it. Okay, so let's have a look at seeking the object of meditation. And the question is, how are we advised to seek our object of meditation? Yeah. So just do this question or one more, and then we better call it quits for today, and we'll leave, I'm not sure, 10 or so for next time. So from the Lamrim Chenmo, it says, when you seek your object of meditation, the basis upon which you first keep your attention, look for an excellent painting or a sculpture of the teacher's body and view it again and again. Remembering its features, firmly familiarize yourself with the mental appearance of the object. Or else, seek your object of meditation by reflecting upon the meaning of the eloquent descriptions of the Buddha's form, which you've heard from your guru, and make this image appear to your mind. So Leah Zales says, once a meditator has chosen a suitable object of observation, so here it's the Buddha, he or she must search for and find it. That is, reach a basic level of proficiency in bringing it to mind at will. So this is what they mean by like to seek it. To be able to bring it to mind at will, have a basic proficiency, ability to actually do that. But Geshe Sopa, so he says, you may have read or heard teachings about the qualities of the Buddha's body, like its color, proportions, major and minor marks, and so on. You should think again and again about what you have heard. Try to bring this description into your mind. You imagine what it is like, and then focus on that image. This way of constructing an image may or may not produce the richness of detail that is ideal. It depends upon the abilities of the individual practitioner. In general, it is easier if you first look at a representation of the Buddha and then bring that image into your mind. In this case, try to find a statue or a painting that is well made. Do not think of it as a piece of metal, stone, or canvas. Rather, think that this is a representative of the Buddha. Look from the bottom up, then from the top down. Look at every aspect. Take note of the color, the shape, the hand positions, the eyes, and so forth. Look at each of these again and again and try to fix them in your mind. Once you are thoroughly familiar with the object, become accustomed to it by cultivating its visualization in your mind again and again. So I'm trying to summarize these steps. So look for an excellent image or remember what you've heard. Imagine it frequently. Reflect upon its meaning often. Imagine the object to be alive and real and be able to bring it to mind at will. And so we'll do that. Our last one, we have, so we've got up to number 20. I'll leave the last seven for last 11 till next time they come in, I think. That's quite visible. Yeah, I'll leave the rest, I think. So the next simple one's the next one, which is it advised to meditate looking at a statue? And then explain the answer. So what do you think?
No.
No, that's right. That's a simple answer. The answer is no. Don't do it.
Because it's not a mental image.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a mental image. And you can't...
Also, there'd be so many different statues. How do you know the one you're looking at is the right one?
Well, that's what you'll have to determine for yourself. Yeah.
And Kalabari is
not computed based on a sense consciousness.
So, Eddie, yeah. Even just with, you know, the image of the right statue, so generally we start with Shakyamuni Buddha in the Mahayana tradition because of that's the elements that we're meditating on, and also Shakyamuni Buddha with the you know, the aura that represents the six perfections. But so, you know, we do our research with that, but like Eddie was saying, you know, it's not a visual thing, is it? It's a memory prompt, and the actual experience is what we're meditating on inside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the objects are the major reason, one of the major reasons for this was why the object's not a sense object is because the senses aren't stable enough to hold it where the mind is. Mental consciousness is much more stable than visual consciousness. Now, mental consciousness is always functioning, whereas visual consciousness is not. Or if you were to try and use somebody describing it to you over and over again, right, and try to become familiar with that. Yeah, so holding the object merely with visual consciousness is not correct. In other words, just staring at the object to keep it in your visual consciousness is not the way to complete karma binding. You must bring the image into your mind. Now, why? Because the achievement of karma binding is based upon mental consciousness. And an object of a mental consciousness appears to the mind, not to any of the sense consciousnesses. In this context, the object of a mental consciousness is a mental image or a concept. Okay, so I think we should stop here. We've got like another 10 or so questions to go, but there's sort of into a new little section there, right, talking about how we start the meditation, developing which to develop first, and so forth. And so maybe just leave those for the next time we see each other. Otherwise, we'll easily be here for another half hour, I'd imagine. So I'll quickly move along to So now we got through 20 at least. Are there any final questions anybody would like to ask? So before we go, so remember these the purifiers for afflicted behavior, ugliness, loving kindness, and so forth. So remember these are put up for those who have the major problem with that. If that's their major thing, then that's what they should deal with. If it's not, of course, then you find something else as your major thing. If you don't have a major thing, then you're equally balanced. You just got to find the one that, you know, still works for now. That's what those sort of materials there for. Okay, so that's what we'll be going through for next week. So Lama Song Kapa's Name and Chenmo, we're going from pages 48 to 55. In the teaching is 22. And Geshe Sopra, it's from 84 to 94. The next week, page 14 to 19 on Written Questions 22. Okay. Looks very nice in the sunshine there, Caroline. Okay. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may we quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into the enlightened state. May the supreme dual body chitta not get born, arise, and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. So also dedicate for...
stop the share, hun.
So some of you parents or close friends that you care for who are going through all sorts of difficulties. Some of them all based around COVID. Others have had very close pets die. Still others have had family members die. So I'd like to dedicate the merit that we have accumulated today. May it go towards accomplishing the aspirations we have for others. Okay, so thank you everyone, and we'll see you all again next time we're back.